That hymn leads us into our subject this morning, which is called Recovering a God-Centered Vocation. Recovering a God-Centered Vocation. Will you turn with me to the book of Ezra? We read from this book some time ago when we had a guest preacher. But this morning we're not going to look at Ezra, who doesn't appear for some time in the book. We're going to look at Ezra chapter 5. If you can't find Ezra too well, go to Psalms and work backward, and then by diligent search you should eventually come to the book of Ezra. We're looking at a little nook of Ezra which will not be your favourite bedtime reading, I'm quite sure. It may be unfamiliar to you, but it has something to say to us all this morning. Recovering a God-centred vocation from the book of Ezra. Chapter 5, we begin at verse 1, we read to verse 5, and then we break off because there are two lengthy pieces of correspondence which are rather off-putting to most people. And then we shall go over to chapter 6 at verse 13. But first of all, Ezra chapter 5, verse 1. Then the prophet Haggai and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophets, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. So Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and Jeshua the son of Jozadak rose up and began to build the house of God which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them helping them. At the same time Tattenai the governor of the region beyond the river and Shethar-Boznai and their companions came to them and spoke thus to them, "Who has commanded you to build this temple and finish this wall?" Then accordingly we told them the names of the men who were constructing this building. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so that they could not make them cease, till a report could go to Darius. Then a written answer was returned concerning this matter. And then, of course, follow the two documents, one sent by Tattenai, and the other returned by Darius the king. And that takes us over now to chapter 6 and to verse 13. You can read these letters this afternoon. That will be a gainful occupation for you, save you from slumbering over the fireside. Then Tattenai, governor of the region beyond the river, Shethar-Boznai and their companions diligently did according to what King Darius had sent. So the elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, and they built and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel and according to the command of Cyrus, Darius and Artaxerxes king of Persia. Now the temple was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Then the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites, and the rest of the descendants of the captivity celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. And with these words, our readings end. The reason why Cyrus released the captives from Babylonia and allowed them to return to Jerusalem was for the building of the second temple. That's made very, very clear in his proclamation, which you will find at the beginning of Ezra and again at the beginning of chapter 6 of Ezra. Now, there were other reasons why the exiles were returning. Their return would give them a greater measure of freedom than they had known for a long time. It would enable them to repopulate the land which had been denuded by Nebuchadnezzar. It would give them a chance to have a viable lifestyle in a way that God intended. All these are good reasons, but they're secondary ones. The prime reason, the raison d'etre for the return, was the building of the house of God in Jerusalem. That's why they came back. The problem was, dear friends, that the building of the second temple, or Zerubbabel's temple as it is called, had some difficulties about it. First of all, they raised the altar of sacrifice and reused it. Then they laid the foundations amid scenes of mixed emotion. Some wept and some were joyful. They ordered materials for the temple, and then there was a big problem. There's a maxim which states that no serious work of God ever goes unchallenged. Do remember that. Nothing for God is ever easy. It is always extremely difficult. Now, their problem seems to us to be no problem at all. Some kind people came along, as they did with Nehemiah, and offered to help them to rebuild it. They were people we know as the Samaritans. They were of mixed origin. And so they said to Zerubbabel and Joshua, "We worship your God in the same way that you worship him, so we ought to have a part in this project." Well, they received a very dusty answer. Zerubbabel and Joshua turned down their offer outright. "We alone," they said, "have been picked by God to build this structure. You have nothing to do with it." From that moment, the would-be helpers became implacable enemies. They tried every trick in their repertoire, and it was pretty vast, to discourage the builders. They kept trying, and eventually the builders capitulated. Discouraged and disconsolate, worn down by shivering and harassment, the builders gave up. If you just look at the last verse of the previous chapter to our first reading, that is the end of chapter 4, you'll find at verse 24 a description of a situation. It says, "Thus the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem ceased, and it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia." It has been estimated that that period was about 15 years. So for 15 years, the building site was vacated. Not one stone was put on another, and the work of God on the house of God stopped. But such is the human heart, that once one priority is taken away, another one takes its place. When they stop working for God, when they lost their God-centered vocation, to use the title I have given you, they started working for themselves. When they lost interest in God's house, they began to get very interested in their own houses. Not just to have reasonably comfortable shelters, but in some cases to have luxurious homes, such as you see advertised on the hoardings as you drive past today. Luxury villas, luxury this, luxury that. They went in for luxury. They became concerned with themselves. For when people are not God-centered, they become self-centered. It's an inescapable situation. They were either centered on God, or they were centered on themselves. And they became extremely concerned, not just with survival, but with prosperity. And this went on for a long time. So long, indeed, that the idea of getting back to working on the temple seemed far distant. Why go back to something which was difficult and could be dangerous? Why go back to something which was hard and frustrating and sometimes disappointing? Why not postpone the building for a future occasion, or even leave it to another generation to do it? And that is, of course, where the chasm of the centuries collapses. And those people stand by our side this morning. Indeed, they sit with us in the pew. The question is this, and it's still early enough in the year to ask it, and I'm still pastorally minded enough to ask it: are you this morning, at the beginning of this year, God-centered or self-centered? Were you once very God-centered, ambitious for God, doing your best to glorify God in your daily life and in your worship in this fellowship, but you have become frustrated and disappointed, and it's too hard to think about returning to it again. You're opting for a much easier way of life. Now, you alone can answer that question. It's a very personal question. In fact, some of you who don't know me may think I'm really impertinent to ask it. But there it is. It's the question which verse 24 of chapter 4 asks. Are you a God-centered person today? Now, I'm not suggesting that you can carry on the same work that you do for God throughout your whole life, because I would deny that by my retirement. There are things you do for God that you can't do when you get older, but you can still live a God-centered life. Your chief purpose should still be to glorify God. Paul, who was contemplating the possibility of death when he wrote to the church at Philippi, said, I want Christ always to be magnified in my body, now and in the future. That is my aim. Whether it be by life or by death, Christ must be first. My life must be God-centered. That's why, of course, he wrote those familiar words to the Colossians, on which I preached the last time I occupied this pulpit. If you are risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. So at this early stage in the year, I hope you're not offended by this challenge, but I hope you take it aboard, because I have, personally. Am I self-centered, or have I still retained my God-centered living? It's difficult once you lose it to get back to it. And God knew that. And that's why in chapter 5 in our reading, and in chapter 6 in our reading, God had his own methodology, his own methods for bringing his people back to God-centered living. You see, here was the temple standing as a mockery of the return. It was a folly at which people could scoff. Here were people who had started and were not able to finish. Something God detests. Anything that's unfinished, God hates. I'm using very strong language. God hates unfinished work for him. He is a God who finishes every work he undertakes. And as God looked down on that temple, the stump of a building, incomplete, it was a shambles. It was a disgrace. He was ashamed of it. And he had to use some methods to bring his people back to working on the temple again. So let's now spend the balance of the time, which some of you will be hoping is not too long, but it'll take a wee while, to look at some of the methods God used, and they're astonishingly relevant. God is very similar in his methodology in chapter 5 and in chapter 6 to the methods he uses today. You'll be surprised at how familiar they are. So let's look at the first method that God used to bring the self-centered people back to being a God-centered people. From neglecting God's work to engaging in God's work. First of all, you will see from chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, that God used the method of prophetic exhortation. He sent two men to preach. Not to entertain them. Not to do a dance. But to speak to them. Now the fact is, if you look at this passage, you will see that God had to do that because Zerubbabel and Joshua, who were the leaders, were themselves discouraged. They were the men who were supposed to be inspiring this group of people, this community, to work in the house of God, but they themselves had succumbed to discouragement. They had given up. So God had to pick two men, call two men, raise up two men, send two men to preach to them. Now, I've mentioned this before, so you'll know about this. Those two men were entirely different. That's the great thing about God, and the thing I kept telling you before I retired. God uses different men for his glory. And characteristically, temperamentally, those two men were poles apart. Haggai was a very peremptory and practical preacher. He called a spade a spade. He basically said, get up and get cracking. There's no excuse for your laziness. Get back to the work of God. Oh, Zechariah was different. He was visionary and mystical. He used all sorts of wonderful pictures. If you like, Haggai was the extrovert. Zechariah was the introvert. But God used those two men in a wonderful way because they succeeded in their preaching. Notice what verse 2 says. So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, rose up and began to build. What a joy to the preacher when people actually do what the preacher says. But then, of course, those two men were recognized. Those two men were no mendicants, fakes, charlatans, out to make money for themselves. Look at how they are described. They are described as prophets of God in verse 2. That's a great description. And the prophets of God were with them, helping them. Those men were bona fide, genuine servants of God, called by God, anointed by God, with God's message on their lips, different characteristically, temperamentally, different in their approach and in their language, but genuine messengers of God. And God used them in a wonderful revival. And the leaders rose up, and the community followed them. We need preachers. We need preachers. That's one of God's ways, still unchanged, of bringing his people from selfishness to godliness. The man of God, filled with the Spirit of God, preaching the Word of God, is God's method for his people today. It's not drama. It's not entertainment. It's not music. It's the message of God preached in the power of the Spirit of God. And it's our duty, and I include myself in it because I am a member of this church, by the way, to pray that God will send such a man to us here in Longstone Street. We need someone who knows God, who knows the Word of God, and can relevantly and powerfully expound the Scriptures of God to keep us as a church from becoming self-centered. Now, he'll not be an Old Testament prophet, and as we heard on Wednesday night, he will not be a New Testament apostle, but he will be a 21st century pastor sent by God. The first method that God uses is prophetic exhortation, and it worked. And it still works today. There's nothing like being exposed to the preaching of the pure Word of God. Let's look at the second method. The second method you will find is in verse 5. And it is sovereign protection. Prophetic exhortation, sovereign protection. Verse 5 says this: But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so that they, that is the government officials, could not make them cease till a report could go to Darius. Now let me just explain a little about this, because I know it's not too familiar to some of you. Others may be experts unknown to me. But there's a man here crops up at verse 3 called Tatenai. And I want to say a word on his behalf. He's a good fellow. Now, it's very hard to say things good about civil servants, I've found, during my life. Beg pardon, Packy, all civil servants were present. Tat and I was a civil servant. He was an underling. He was a governor who was responsible to Darius. And when he saw this structure continue and these great stones being used and employed, he had to ask some questions. It was his job. That's what the speed cop says, you know, when he stops you. "It's only my job, mister." Doesn't make the fine, of course, any easier, but there it is. Tatanai was doing his job. He had to ask. So he comes along and he says in verse 3, "Who has commanded you to build this temple and finish it?" And there's nothing secret about it. In verse 4, the names of the men are revealed. And they are also told, although it's not mentioned specifically here, that they have authority to build. And that authority was given long ago. Now, it would have been very easy, you see, for Tatanai, because he had political clout and he had military clout, to have stopped the building. He had force behind him. He had power on his side. And if he had been an overzealous civil servant, and some civil servants are overzealous, he could have said, "Oh, well, stop this. We'll have no more of this. I'm a red tape man, and I must get all the documentation in triplicate, and the work must stop until that happens." Here's a wonderful statement. Look at verse 5. "But the eye of their God was upon them." Now, that just doesn't mean that God knew about them. It means that God actually protected them. There was, if you like, an invisible shield around them. Tat and I couldn't see it, but it was there. There was just something about them that stopped Tat and I from saying, "Okay, let this work cease until I get authentication from the king." He couldn't do it. God had built a shield, or if you like, the angel of the Lord was encamping round about them, and God was protecting the people who had gone back to work, because God does that. You see, if God commands you to do something, God will protect you in the doing of it. No matter how difficult it is, no matter how dangerous it is, no matter how daunting it is. That's one of the excuses that the people had raised. They had said, "Well, we won't come back to work in this temple site because it could be dangerous." But God's protection was round about them. A sovereign protector they had, unseen, but forever at hand. And God still uses that method today. Can I say to you, if you haven't continued God's work, if you become self-centered, and you're saying, "Oh, to go back to glorifying God in my life, to becoming an active, zealous Christian, could even be dangerous for me. Difficult in the family, difficult in my social circle, difficult at my work," God will keep his eye on you. And you're safe until your days of service are over. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, can I say, as a little caveat before I finish this point, that the people who are working in the temple could act foolishly and provocatively and say Yabu or other things in the Aramaic language to Tatanai. No, they had to be respectful, but still, God was using this method. The method of prophetic exhortation, the method of sovereign protection. Have to hurry on. Brings back old memories. I was always saying that. Let's come to chapter 6. And in chapter 6, we come to another method. What has happened here in this interval that we have skipped over, and we've all going to read this afternoon, of course, instead of sleeping, is this: a letter has gone to Darius, you see, quoting many things and asking Darius if he can verify what those men have said. Have they got the authority? Is this true? Are they pulling his leg? Are they working a fast one? Are they being slick? Now, what has to happen is this. A document has to be found. So we come to the third method that God uses, and that's the method of very careful preservation. A document. A document issued a long time ago by Cyrus, and it has to be discovered. Where is it? Is it in Babylon? It's only a document, you know, a piece of papyrus with the official authorization for the building of the temple and the provision of materials. But where is it? A long time has passed. The work has ceased for 15 years. Whatever could happen to a document? Well, lots of things can happen to a document, can't they? And you'll enlighten yourself a lot by reading these two letters. You'll find a great deal in them. I can't tell you today, I haven't the time. But a search was instituted. And you know, the document wasn't found in Babylon. It wasn't there. It was found, though, in a city very far away from Babylon called Ecbatana. And some very careful clerk had filed it. And there it was. It was the proclamation of Cyrus, authorizing the Jews to return to Jerusalem to build the house of God and granting them materials to do so. Amazing. One document. Not something the size of the pulpit, but just a slender papyrus roll. And God had looked after it very carefully, so that at the right time, some other civil servant went up and said, "Wow, I remember that document now. I can take you to the very cabinet where it's stored. I'll bring it out. Here it is." Now, that wasn't all. You see, when the king sent back his letter saying that the document had been found, if you look at verse 11 of chapter 6, you will see that he added a penalty to anyone who tried to disturb the workers. "Also, I issue a decree," this was very typical of kings in those days, of course, "that whoever alters this edict, let a timber be pulled from his house and erected, let him be hanged on it, and let his house be made a refuse heap because of this. And may the God who causes his name to dwell there destroy any king or people who put their hand to alter it or to destroy this house of God which is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, issued a decree. Let it be done diligently." So actually, you see, that document not only authorized the continuance of the work, but strengthened the position of the people who worked. Anyone who tried to stop them, to put it basically, were for it. I often think it must have been wonderful to work for some of these emperors, you know. You didn't know when you set out in the morning whether you're going to be hanged or whether you're going to be rewarded. Whether you're going to come back to your house at night or come back to a dunghill. It must have been very pleasant to be employed by them. That's what they were like. And this powerful king says, "Look here, don't let anyone touch those men. I have used the method of careful preservation. I've watched over that document, and it's there." That's the kind of God we have. That's why there's no problem, you know, about going back as far as the fear of man is concerned. We don't need to worry about men. We have been authorized by God to do his work. Do you know, I have been a pastor for 32 years. This will not come as a surprise to some of you. No one ever laid hands on my head and told me I was set aside for this work. Nobody. I never had an ordination service in my life. And I'm glad I didn't have one. My authority came from God. It's God who gifts a man. It's God who authorizes a man. It's God who sends a man. And if God has called you to a work, and God has called you by salvation to live a God-glorifying life, live it! You've got God behind you. What need you fear? What can man do unto you? Now finish. Oh, joy or delight? Well, that is the finish. God has used the method of prophetic exhortation sent to preachers. Preachers who are different in temperament, characteristically, but it worked and the building started. God used the method of sovereign protection. They went on with the work and nobody stopped them. God used the method of very careful preservation. There was a document which he looked after, slender and small though it was, and when it was recovered, it strengthened their authorization to continue in the work. And if we look at the end of our reading, you'll see it, verse 15. God used the method of joyful completion. Joyful completion. Then the children of Israel... verse 15. Now the temple was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius. That's about 4.5 years after it began to be rebuilt. Verse 16. Then the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites, and the rest of the descendants of the captivity celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. Let me remind you of the difference between the completion and the laying of the foundation. The laying of the foundation was mingled with joy and sadness. People look back to the old temple of Solomon and its glory and they said, oh well, this house is nothing like that. Young people who had not seen Solomon's house were jolly happy that the work was starting. But here in verse 16, it's unmitigated joy. There's nobody crying. Nobody crying. They've completed it. What a joy. If you look down the chapter just a little, you'll come to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because lots of things happen subsequent to that. And when we come to the Feast of Unleavened Bread at verse 22, it says, and they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord made them joyful. Now I want to speak to you young people. This sounds awful like an old preacher, doesn't it? I want to speak to you young people, anybody under 50, young in my reckoning. Don't miss the joy of finishing a work for God. There's a tremendous joy because it's a God-given joy. Now, I want to say this reflectively as I finish today, and you've all listened very patiently. It alarms me sometimes, and I'm not easily alarmed, but despite the fact I'm not easily alarmed, it does alarm me sometimes how Christians who are getting older have never really done anything for God that I know of, and it doesn't worry them. Now, I may be wrong, I may be misjudging some people, and I'm not thinking about anybody in particular, so don't be sitting there blushing saying, that man's thinking about me. He's not. But you know, if you get to the age of 40 and 50 and you've never really done anything at all in your life that will stand for eternity, you ought to be very worried. Very worried. That doesn't mean you've got to be a preacher, you know, or a missionary. But it means that you have brought your gift to God and said, Lord, this is what you've given me. I want to use that for you. And you have the joy of knowing that under God, God has used you and blessed you. I wouldn't like to be in your shoes today, quite frankly. If you're in middle life and you haven't yet pursued a truly God-centered vocation. Time is going in very quickly, you know. I was speaking to a group of people yesterday who by their own confession are totally non-churchgoers. And in faithfulness to God, I had to say to them, please remember your mortality. Please remember your mortality. You're a frail being. They were all very respectable, educated people. But I had to say to them, listen, life is very short. Now, dear friends, we can be very faithful to the unsaved, but we're not so diligent about ourselves. Life is short for us all. If you were to ask me this morning, when should I get back to being a God-centered person? I would say, now. I would say now. God alone knows how long you and I have in this life. And if you've got away from God in the past 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 years, and something other than God is filling your horizon, however legitimate it may be, and there are legitimate things that we must do, ask the Lord to forgive you and get back to God now. And pray that God may grant you a few years to live a God-centered life. You maybe didn't come out to hear that, but then I trust I'm God's messenger this morning, and that some of the methods I've mentioned will bring you and I to the place where we put Christ first and everything else, including ourselves, in a secondary position. May God bless his word.